Short is so much better than him and has always beaten him. At one point, he laughed out loud at a move of Nigel's, which was absolutely necessary, precise and accurate. Really sad. He spent some time in a funny farm, so one mustn't hate. Spielman turned up and was friendly, chatted to Ray Keane and others. Nigel managed to draw and acquitted himself well over the board, beaten in preparation perhaps, but excellently played. Alistair then arrived, and we had a drink and stepped over to Joe Allen's for dins. Saw Maggie Hambling, and of all people, Amanda Barry. Footnote, Carry On Cabby, Coronation Street. Once I'd got to know her better, it wasn't that surprising that she was in Maggie's company. End footnote. Sitting at a table with Percy, Maggie's terrier. Then came home, drank a bottle of red wine, and wrote this. Now, must bed myself. Off to Witten tomorrow for Joe, sister, and Richard's christening party for my nephew George. Footnote. Witten is an RAF station where Richard, husband to Joe and father to George, was based. End footnote. Sunday, the 3rd of October, 1993. Drove to RAF Witten. You have to report to the guardhouse and get a chit, which you stick to your dashboard. Found Joe and Richard's quarters. Arrived same time as Roger, Ruthie, Ben and William. Ben and William V affectionate and sweet. Joe looking fearfully well, and George bouncing fit to bust. Splendid fellow. None of the usual stickiness you expect from these family affairs. Almost frighteningly English. The christening itself took place in the church on the station, a rather cute little affair with shiny rafters. Simply ghastly ASB, alternative service book, form of christening. Even the Lord's Prayer was tampered with. Nice padre, but V low. Came back for buns and cake. Got away sharpish and returned to London. Spot of TV and bed. Monday, the 4th of October, 1993. Well, a day spent entirely in the flat once more, and a day that has seen me finish the novel. Well, I say that, but when is a novel ever finished? I dotted the point final, as the French say, at round about 6:30, and ever since have been combing through the main body, rewriting. I suspect the length will be round about 96,000 words when we're done. Stephen, you are such a size queen. Stopped off to watch the second ep of Robbie Coltrane's Cracker, even better than the first, simply spot on. This was followed by News at 10, with all the pictures of Moscow's new October Revolution. It'll all drift into dim memory in a fortnight or so, but what a day! Tanks blasting holes in the side of the Parliament building, hundreds killed. Could it happen here, we wonder? Only worrying thing is that I somehow succumbed and opened a bottle of wine at nine-ish, most of which I've consumed. Really must get into the habit of passing through a day without any alcohol. Hey-ho, up early-ish tomorrow, please, Stephen, and perhaps it will all be really, really, really done. Night. Tuesday, 5th of October, 1993. Finished. Well, perhaps there's more work to do, but I've printed it out, sent a copy to Hugh Laurie, and feel that it's out. Immediately rang Sue, but she's at the Frankfurt Book Fair, and so I won't send it to her until tomorrow or Monday even, as she won't be back for the rest of the week. Rang the Laurie's, though, and have cabbed it off to Hugh. God knows what it's like. Feel hot and cold about it. The evening saw a dinner at W.H. Smith's headquarters in Holbein Place off Sloane Square. Sir Simon Hornby, the chairman, had invited me to dinner. Turned up in time, after a couple of lines, still left over from Liam's kind sale on Thursday. Drove the taxi. Interesting people there. The Rue brothers, Hugh Johnson, the wine writer, Edward Cazalet, Plum Woodhouse's grandson, and others. Strangely serendipitous going to a Smith's dinner on the very day I finished the Nov. They served Chateau Latour and Merlot, highly enjoyable. I got very drunk indeed. Wednesday, 6th of October, 1993. Spent the day sorting out all the correspondence that had built up over the weeks since I'd been concentrating on the Hippo. Then I posted it and went shopping. Had lunch with Lowe and Christian at the agency. Then walked to Mortimer Street and bought An Apple Newton. Wow, what a piece of kit. It's going to take a little time before it can read my handwriting, but this is the way technology is going, no question. Footnote. Sadly, the Newton was somewhat before its time, but it was indeed the way technology was going. Handheld, touchscreen, although with a stylus, many things to like and admire in it. End footnote. In the evening, went to Victoria Wood's concert at the Royal Albert Hall. Met up with Hugh and Ben Elton. Ben's manager, Phil McIntyre, is the promoter of VW and arranged a good box for us. Afterwards, we trotted off to the Bombay Brasserie, where Ben and I and the Kinnocks dined the other night, and spent a wondrous evening chatting. Hugh is reading Ben's novel as well as mine at the moment, so I've got a fluttery tummy, especially as I've suddenly lost confidence in the hippo, and wonder what on earth I was at, writing such a hard-to-define novel. Thursday, 7th of October, 1993. Hugh came round this morning to start writing on the next series of A Bit of Fry and Laurie. No 2-week holiday after the intensity of the hippo and all else. Come to think of it, when did I ever have a holiday? We didn't get much done, but it was so good to have him here. In the afternoon, Griff Rhys-Jones rang up to invite me to a poker game at the Groucho. After Hugh left, I wandered to the Groucho, and the game happened. You have never seen so much coke in your life. How Griff resists it, I do not know. XY, footnote, no, not telling, end footnote, was there too, and the white powder simply flowed. I played poker pretty well, despite some very bad hands, and managed to exploit what little luck I had. The effect of the sea and a lot of red wine began to take its toll on me, but on no one else, and towards the end of the evening, I, embarrassingly, threw up out of the window onto Dean Street below. Liam had a look and said there was no one there, no policeman, no unfortunate victim of the chunder. Shame, indignation, and horror. It reminds me of the time when I was with, insert names of huge rock star, huge acting name, huge producer name here, in the back office of the 24 Hours Cafe in Kingley Street, and we decided to have a longest line competition. Each of us chopped out a line, mine being the longest, but the point was we had to take it up in one, a vile version of the shot glasses down in one horror. On that occasion, I took the line up my nose, it must have been 7 foot long, but thin, hoovered it up, and as I got to the end of the table, opened my mouth and let out gallons of pure bright red vomit. Not quite as bad as that this evening. Everybody very nice about it, but what a humiliation. Struggled home somehow. Friday, 8th of October, 1993. Quieter day. Hugh arrived late, and we worked a bit. I wrote a sketch of appalling double entendre quality, footnote, known as The Understanding Barman. Quite proud of it now. I think we thought it was a satire on Ronnie Barker-style innuendo, but of course such innuendo is funny. End footnote. And then Hugh left. Played with the new Newton, watched a few videos, and then went to bed. Saturday, 9th of October, 1993. Bought some French videos to watch actors for the movie Bachelors Anonymous that I've been asked to direct next year. The Lorries invited me to dinner, and I popped over. Nigel Short lost his match today for the first time for weeks. Big shame. Came home, got a bit drunk, and wrote up these last few days. Forgive my brevity of late. Good night. Sunday, 10th of October, 1993. Woke up good and dominically late. Had a lunch at the Ivy with John Reed, Elton John's manager, and Arlene Phillips, the choreographer. They had asked me some time ago to see if I couldn't come up with a narrative framework for Elton's songs, with a view to putting on a West End show. I wrote the book in February to March this year. Reed and Arlene like it. John R. has just come back from L.A., where he showed it to Bernie Taupin, Elton's lyricist, who, as I suspected, did not like it at all. Accused it of being cliché-ridden, which is true, but inevitable for a West End Broadway musical, and Elton's early life of transgressive sex, excess, drugs, rock and roll was, frankly, cliché-ridden. Still, John and Arlene want to go ahead, so I'm to ring Sam Mendes tomorrow, as John John likes the idea of his being the director. John, who'll produce, will see Sam when John gets back from Hong Kong next week. As well as being Elton's manager, he's also Billy Connolly's, and until a month or so ago, Barry Humphrey's. Well, it may or may not take. The story is full of gay stuff, which will at least make it different. It's unhip and uncool, which is what Torpin dislikes, naturally. Torpin thinks of himself as some kind of hep village guy from the 60s, sort of neurotica beat generation cool dude poet, still trying to escape the fact that he's a Lincolnshire farm lad gone middle-aged and millionaireoid. Footnote. This is awful. I met Bernie Torpin a year or so later and found him to be just about the most endearing fellow you could ever encounter, not in the least self-deluded or spoiled by his enormous success with Elton. End footnote. Came back, watched TV, and wrote this. Still haven't watched any French stuff to see what I think of French actors for Bachelors Anonymous. Hugh round again tomorrow for more F&L writing. Glunk. Monday, 11th of October, 1993. I'm a bit behind diary-wise, and I'm writing this later. Damned if I can remember what happened today. Wrote with Hugh in the morning and afternoon. And then what? Tuesday, 12th of October, 1993. More writing with Hugh during the day, and then popped over to the Groucho to see if I could find some coke to ingest before dinner at Lescargot with Panina, my second cousin's wife, and Leora, her daughter. They were all right, actually. Could have been a lot worse. Desperate to know what the rest of the world thought of Israel's peace moment with the PLO. Lescargot just recently reopened, and Jimmy Mahoud, the new owner, was absolutely thrilled to see me there and stood me cognacs and all the rest of it. Okay evening. Walked home nearly sober. Wednesday, 13th of October, 1993. Strange day. Wrote with Hugh up until 5, when Mother came round to pick up a copy of The Hippo, which she wants to read. We gossiped for a while, and then I had to change for the evening. Tristan Garrell Jones had invited me to dinner. Arrived first at his Catherine Place address. Highly bonhomous cove, far too civilised to be a convincing Tory. Other guests included the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kenneth Clark, the Chief Whip, Richard Ryder, and assorted sprigs of the nobility, chiefly female, Leonora Litchfield, Jane Grosvenor, that kind of thing, had damn good chat with them all and raised the subject of tomorrow's debate at the Cambridge Union, viz. The Age of Consent. Triss was all for a free vote if it ever gets to the House of Commons. Richard Ryder, Mar and Pa's local MP in Norfolk, as it happens, was being very tricksy about it. This horrific shite that the government have been spewing about family values recently, since Blackpool, in fact, may mean that they are not interested in things like justice and equality at the expense of the blue hair vote. Left the dinner early because Griff had invited me to a card game at the Groucho. Eventually it took place, rather knackering business, lots of sea. Managed to struggle home at 2-ish. Thursday, 14th of October, 1993. Had to be up very early in time for the Today programme on the consent and Cambridge debate issue. Felt like shit, as you can imagine, after the excesses of the evening before. Eventually, after a great deal of hanging about, I got to the studio where Anna Ford and Brian Redhead were at their microphones. I was to deliberate with the Conservative MP David Wilshire, a sponsor of Clause 28. In fact, he said nothing I disagreed with. He made a libertarian point about it not being the law's business to interfere with what people do in private, and left it at that. No debate to speak of at all. Got back and dozed until Hugh arrived for writing. Spent a lot of the day not writing, but thinking about what I was going to say in the evening. John Plowman turned up at 12:30. He and Bob Spears, I hope, are going to produce and direct, respectively, the next Fry and Laurie. Footnote. Indeed they did. Bob Spears, now deceased sadly, was an old hand from the Golden Age who had directed dozens of episodes of Dad's Army, Are You Being Served, It Ain't Half Hot Mum, and, crucially, the second series of Fawlty Towers, which rendered him holy. John Plowman, an old friend from Granada al fresco days, who would go on to be probably the BBC's longest-serving head of comedy, ushering in Ab Fab, The Office, Little Britain, etc. End of footnote. We lunched at Langan's, once we had tracked down poor Bob Spears, who was lost and wandering desperately round St. James's. I think they would be perfect, those two, and I believe Hugh thinks so too. Highly amiable and capable of delivering much higher production values. Lunch was fine and fun, mostly gossip, but we agreed that we should proceed. Sir Ian McKellen, or Serena McKellen, as Kim told me he should more properly be addressed, showed up at about 4:30, as did Michael Bywater, who is on the opposition benches opposing the motion, "This House believes in an equal age of consent for homosexual and heterosexual acts." Poor old Michael agreed to do the debate without knowing that he was going to oppose, claims he can't think of anything to say against the idea. Drove to Cambridge, traffic in London bad. Arrived a little late for the pre-debate drinks and dinner. There was already a hell of a queue leading into the Union Building. Dinner was fine, not a culinary excitement, but fine. The president was an elegant girl called Lucy Fraser, and to my left was a sporting chappie called something or other. He was from King's and reading theology. Why have I forgotten his name already? Also, there was Tristram Hunt, who is the son of the Hunts who live plumb spang next door to Hugh and Joe Laurie. Simply a poppet. He was speaking on our behalf. Footnote. Now a Labour MP and dashing broadcaster who makes fine documentaries on history. End footnote. Anyway, eventually time to debate. We marched into the chamber with Newsnight cameras on our heels. Huge cheer for me. They just wouldn't stop. It was awfully sweet. Felt like blubbing. The President got things off to some kind of start, and Tristram Hunt opened the debate for us. Four speakers on each side. Tristram, Serena McKellen, Angela Mason of Stonewall Group, and self, proposing, and two undergraduates, including the one whose name I've forgotten, Stephen Green of the Conservative Family Campaign, and Michael Bywater, opposing. Tristram put the case pretty ably, bless him. Our first undergraduate opposer was a cheery Scottish Conservative, classic stout gingery politico. He was an indication of things to come, for it was clear that he did not believe in the position he had to take up at all. Serena then spoke, quite wonderfully, very moving indeed, ending up with a recitation from Houseman's poem about the laws of God and man. Then the student whose name I can't remember. He was so disrespectful to the idea of the motion that Stephen Green got up and walked out. "I'll come back when he's finished," he said, highly entertaining. Angela Mason next. She's the very extraordinary lesbotic campaigner who runs Stonewall. Used to be a member of the Angry Brigade. Narrowly escaped conviction at some bombing trial. She was, as you would expect, dull and uninspired as a debater. Then Stephen Green. What a ghastly and unfortunate specimen. Simply hopeless performance. Witless, graceless, and useless. Didn't even try and present his real point of view, which is that he abominates anything to do with whoopsiedom. Instead, he tried to make some feeble, pettifogging legal point about the age of consent, which made no sense at all. He presented his book, The Sexual Dead End, some magisterial work, we are given to believe, outlining the dreadfulness of being a bottomite. Poor man. Sat down to, at the most, polite splatters of applause. Then it was time for the floor debate. Oh yes, Stephen, as usual, has to wait and wait and wait before he can speak. Undergraduates on this side and that spoke. Finally, it was my turn. I jotted a few things down on the back of an envelope, as it were, during the debate, but otherwise entirely busked, which is definitely the best way of doing things, I think. Told them all about Cambridge and what kind of a place they were attending, the history of its alumni and what they stood for. Contrasted this with the adulterers, closet cases and corrupt canters who get up at Tory party conferences and dare presume to talk about family values. The long and the short of it was that I got a standing ovation, which made me all trembly. They just wouldn't stop applauding me and cheering and all the rest. Very exciting. Michael Bywater spoke next and said he opposed the motion because he believed that the age of consent should not be equal. Heterosexual love was far too complex and difficult a thing to allow 16-year-olds to engage in it. Homosexual love was fine. It was a matter for equals and those who know each other and should happily be set at 16. He ended by saying, "I'm sitting with the faggots," crossed the bench and sat with us. Well, as you can imagine, we carried the day. 693 votes to 30. Of the 30, it was mostly those who found the queue into the I door too long and voted by filing through the no, was kept for at least an hour signing autographs in a great crush of undergraduacy. For the large part, not the most bouncily charming bunch, Rory, Nicole, John, would be shouted at me as an order paper was put under my nose to be signed. Very few pleases or thank yous. One can overlook a lot by imagining that they were shy or nervous, but generally speaking a disappointing set. There is no point in being shiny, attractive, intelligent and young unless you beam it out, whatever your gender, to those older than you. Eventually managed to get through to the room where drinks were supposed to be served. Bar had closed by that time, natch. No bad thing since I was driving home. This we did once Serena, Michael and a couple of others could be prized away. I got home and to bed by about 2:30. Long day. Little sleep lately. Friday, 15th of October, 1993. Woke up early enough to do a voiceover at 9. Really, that's so many late nights now, I'm beginning to think all the work of Greyshot is being undone. Pretty feeble ads for Croft Sherry. Got back in time for Hugh to come round, and we stuck at it all day. Anthony Goff, my lit agent, rang to say that he really loved the hippo, which was a huge relief. I do honestly think he meant it. Robin Hardy came round at 5:30, and we chewed the fat on the subject of Bachelors Anonymous. I told him that Thierry Lhermitte was my certain favourite for the lead. He seemed to think that this was a good idea, and promised to try and see if he could book him. At 7, I biffed to the Groucho to see if I could spot a dealer of any kind. B.W. introduced me to a chap called Jethro, who sold me a gram. Then I loped off to Hughes and Joe's for dinner. Alistair and Kim were there, and we had a jolly dinner before I ripped off home again by way of the Grouch. I am back to my bad old ways with a vengeance. Saturday, 16th of October, 1993. Signing tour. Up early for a car to Euston Station, where I meet Rebecca Salt of Mandarin Books, and we got on the train for Chester. Late, unfortunately. Trouble at Watford. This meant we were late for Chester, and only just arrived in time for my performance. This involved a reading and chat on stage at the Gateway Theatre. Read the Sherlock Holmes story from Paperweight. Footnote, an earlier book of mine, a salmagundi of writings that you are sure to find delightful and a perfect gift, too, for a hated one. End footnote. And then took questions. Very good fun, really. Seemed to go well. Then we grabbed a late lunch and signed some stock in a couple of bookshows in the Chester Rose. Beautiful city, quite entrancing. Car from Chester to Liverpool, where we signed again and leapt on a train for London. Did some fatuous IQ test for Esquire magazine on the way. Went straight to the Groucho and hung around for a while. Jethro showed up and I bought 2 grams. Finally, fell into bed in some kind of a state at 3. Sunday, 17th of October, 1993. Lunch with Ferdy Fairfax in Clapham. Charles Sturridge and Phoebe showed up. Robert Fox, those sort of people. Rather fine affair. Hearty Sunday lunch food. Lots of children. Very bright sunny autumn day. Splendid. Footnotes. Ferdy Fairfax. Director of 2 series of Jeeves and Wooster, also now sadly no longer with us. Charles Sturridge, directed Brideshead Revisited at some preposterously young age and married Phoebe Nichols, who played Cordelia quite brilliantly. Robert Fox, producer brother of actors James and Edward. End footnotes. Home at 6, watched telly and went to bed sober and early. Monday, 18th of October, 1993. Press launch of Stalag Luft, screening and photo call and all that. Took place at the Imperial War Museum. Watched it. Think it's all right. Hard to tell. It's a good story, so it should work well. I was fat, naturally. Nick Lyndhurst and I had to fend questions from the press. They were all dead keen to know about the Elton John musical, much to the distress of the poor popsy from the press office. Tore myself away at 1:30, just in time to get home, before Hugh showed up at 2 for writing. met Chris Pye of Anglia and Anthony Horowitz, the writer, for drinks and a chat about a new detective series they want me to do. At the Groucho, naturally. Who was there but David Reynolds, the producer of Stalag Luft and some colleagues? They had been there since the screening finished. TV people. Crumbs. Meeting went okay, then John Sessions showed up with some actress who plays a nurse in Casualty. Home a bit pissed and fell into bed. What a week. Tuesday, 19th of October, 1993. Up and just about capable when Hugh came round. Jo, sister, popped over from Huntingdon to lunch with me and James Penny, my personal banker. They use some phrase like wealth management that makes me so embarrassed I could scream. We lunched there. Dear, dear, have you really come to this, Stephen? All very flattering. You are ushered in by Jeeves-dressed messengers, all striped trousers and tailcoats. There was Bruce, the manager of the Langham Street branch, where I had banked before, and there was James Penny, who looks about 10, but knows his financial onions and his commercial shallots. Downstairs, in one of the dining rooms, we lunched and supped burgundy, while Penny told me that my money was useless as cash, and that I really should do things with it. Guilts, he felt. I've always been dodgy about all this. If I earn the money, I don't see why I then have to make money out of money. But you know what it's like. They look at you as if you're mad. So I suppose I'll sink something into shares, something into gilts. The good thing is that I can afford to stop working and travel the world for a couple of years or whatever, if I felt like it, without worrying about taxes for the previous years. The private bank is open from 8 to 8 and can make any arrangements. If I want cash, they bring it to me on a salver. Came back to write with Hugh. He's written a couple of fabulous songs lately. He left, and I toddled to the Groucho for a meeting with Alex Hippersley Cox, sick, a girl who will be doing the publicity for The Hippo. She likes the book, which is great. People at Hutchinson's who've read it seem to think that it's better than The Liar, which is wonderful if they're right. Stayed on upstairs to watch Norwich beat Bayern Munich 2-1. Unbelievable. Wonderful stuff. A goal from Jeremy Goss that will live long in legend and song. Spike Denton, the Radio London film critic, was there, and Rory McGrath and Charles Fontaine, the owner-chef of the Quality Chop House. Spotted Jethro and nipped off to do some rather decent coke, I'm sorry to say. This is going to have to stop soon. Home at 2. Wednesday, 20th of October, 1993. Up reasonably early to go to Doug Haywood, the tailor, for another fitting. The blue whistle and flute is emerging. Hugh was round a bit late, looking at new cars and tiles for my kitchen, with his wife Jo, who's designing it, bless her, from crown to toe. Wrote during the day, as usual, then stayed in till 10. Watched a video of Bill Humble's Royal Celebration, which was directed by Ferdy Fairfax. Very good performance from Rupert Graves. Watched a vid of Monday's episode of Cracker. Robbie really is giving the performance of his life. Fabulous. At 10, off to the Groucho. I'd agreed to play Perudo with Keith Allen for some programme he's making in which he's being followed around London for a day. Silly, but fun. The cameras whizzed about us. God knows what they saw. Thursday, 21st of October, 1993. Voiceover at 9:30, with John Gordon Sinclair. He seems in fine shape. More writing with Hugh all morning, and then at 7 I arrive at the Tallow Chandler's Hall for a Bowyer's dinner, guest of old John Perkins. Most extraordinary evening. Never been at a livery dinner before. A lot of city figures in ermine and gowns. Fairly clear that they would never otherwise have been able to earn the right to such accoutrements, for these were bears, so far as I could see, of very little brain. A lot of pompous people in spectacles, for the most part. Simply dreadful. But Perkins is such a nice man. There was the whole business of the loving cup and so forth, and the load of exceptionally bad oratory. Perkins had to be back in Norfolk, so he left round about 10-ish, and I got dropped at the Groucho for a card game. Played poker with Griff and Rory and others for about 3 hours, and ingested rather a lot of the old Bolivian marching powder. Friday, the 22nd of October, 1993. Writing in the morning and afternoon. quick pop off to the Grouch for supper. Had a long chat with Bob Mortimer of Reeves and Mortimer fame. Turns out they've got a signing gig tomorrow as well, also to Leeds, but at a different time. Bumped into Zed, who is worried that his sea habit has been going on for too long. Takes it during the day. Bad idea. Got home reasonably early, a little chastened by the thought of Zed, but cheered too to think that I wasn't in such a parlous state as he was. Saturday, 23rd of October, 1993. Up early-ish for King's Cross Station. Train to Leeds, signing. Car to Sheffield, signing. Car to Nottingham, signing. The latter had such a big queue that it was as well that it hadn't been the first, or I would have been late for all the others. Lots of people, all very friendly. Think Paperweight in Paperback is doing really well, which is so heartening. Home by 9:30. Watched a bit of telly, fell into bed sober and knackered after a heavy week. Sunday, 24th of October, 1993. Up at 11, which was really 12 because the clocks went back today. Spent the day preparing for the Palladium gig. This is a benefit for the Stonewall Group, part of the Age of Consent campaign, which the Cambridge Union had been about as well. Got to the Palladium round about 6:30. Ian McKellen was organising the affair, and the usual suspects turned up, Joe Brand, Julian Clary, Pet Shop Boys and so forth. I'd invited Christian Hodell to come along and mix with the merry throng. He seemed to enjoy himself mightily. At the end of the show, walking to the party, I discovered my cab had gone from the street where it had been parked. Christ, I hope it was towed away, not stolen. We strolled on, Christian and I, to the edge in Soho Square. I took about an hour of it before the press of people finally wore me out, and I walked home and tumbled into bed after a couple more lines and some Diet Coke. What an ass I am. Footnote. Just the Diet Coke would now keep me awake for hours, let alone the naughty Coke. End of footnote. Monday, 25th of October, 1993. Before I go any further, I must register Gary Wilkinson's 71 clearance to beat Steve James to a quarter-final place in the Skoda Classic. I know this looks naff, but it was one of the great sporting contests. You, dear reader, will wonder why on earth I'm going on about such a strange thing as snooker, but as the old saying has it, you had to be there. Four incredible hard final reds, and an on-their-spot clearance to follow. I was happy to witness such a moment. Work with Hugh, then lunch with Max Hastings at Wilton's. Max arrived late, and at the neighbouring table, while waiting, I bumped into Don Black, who was meeting John Barry, to whom I was introduced. Footnote. Don Black, astoundingly prolific and successful lyricist, often in collaboration with John Barry. End footnote. Barry happens to be something of a hero, so I was excited to meet him. He turns out to be a very down-the-line Yorkshireman, weirdly thin fingers and hands, and very charming. Lots of gossip about Saltzman and broccoli from the Bond days. Max arrived and told me that if I demanded $200,000 a year, he would happily pay me to provide a column. This is a strange position to be in. I could say yes, and $200,000 would be mine. We nattered about the Tories, and he said that Major, whom he fairly regularly sees, is a paranoid figure who believes his current unpopularity is entirely down to a conspiracy of A. Thatcherite mavericks and renegades, and B. media enemies. Even if Major is right, this attitude should be hidden. A real leader would surely kick ass and establish himself. We also chatted about Lamont's bitterness over his sacking. When it was time to leave the restaurant, we discovered that Lamont was sitting at the neighbouring booth. Whoops. Don't think he was listening. Max turns out to be genuinely anti-Murdoch. He thinks him a completely evil and appalling man. Why isn't this made more plain in the pages of the Telegraph? Murdoch has announced his intention to destroy the Telegraph within the next 5 years. Got back to the flat at 2:40 and wrote some more stuff, then Hugh left. Slept for an hour before driving off to Fulham for dinner with Matthew Rice and Emma Bridgewater, his wife. Chap called Jonathan Cavendish was my neighbour at table. He produced Into the West and The Severed Bride and so forth. Turns out he's doing an Oscar Wilde movie with Alfred Molina. Bollocks. Home in time to watch video Cracker and Film 93. Barry Norman wonderfully vituperative about Dirty Weekend, which is clearly drivel, like every winner movie. Time for bed. Tuesday, 26th October, 1993. Voiceover in the morning, just redoing the old Croft LBV port thing. Hugh and I worked again during the day, and then at 8 I toddled over to the House of Commons to dine with an MP. This man had written to me last month telling me how much he loved The Liar and inviting me to dine with him. Intrigued, I accepted, but if this is the quality of MP that the Tory party is relying on, then I'm happy to say that they are not long for this world. Absurd-looking man with the oddest manner you've ever seen. Sounds very ungracious after I have eaten his bread, but truly, very right-wing in a thoughtless, I made it by the sweat of my brow kind of way. Anyway, went and had a line in the loo. Footnote. See earlier. End footnote. Wednesday, 27th of October, 1993. Spend the morning being painted again by Maggie H. Not too clever at 8:30, but I warmed up and started to enjoy it. She finished off by doing two drawings of me asleep, which was wonderful. She is the most extraordinary woman. Her company is more stimulating than cocaine, but her gruffness of manner and hard glare are apt to frighten off those who don't know that she has a heart of marshmallow. She would probably retch at me saying that. Being painted by a true artist is an extraordinary experience. She's so athletic. All the time I heard the snap of breaking charcoal or the sweep of it on cartridge paper and the stamp of her feet constantly and unconsciously, it seems, readjusting her stance as, like an athlete or a cheetah, her body moved while her eyes and head kept deadly still. Home via the Groucho, where I was supposed to meet Jethro. Unfortunately, he was late, so I left without him or any C. Back at the flat, Joe and Charlie were there. Charlie typed out a message for me on the computer and was generally a poppet. He's 5 now. Weird to think that unless I top myself, OD, or get run over by a bus, I'll live to see him make 25. Footnote. Which he has comfortably done. Well on his way to 30 now. Still a poppet. End footnote. Tried to sketch up, footnote, i.e. write a sketch, end footnote, after they went. Not easy. Went off to the Groucho again to meet Jethro. Missed him again, as I had to get back in time to meet Anthony and Sue F. for a dinner party to celebrate the delivery of the hippo, which they really seemed to like. I felt a bit odd. Wine and ciggies tasted strange in the mouth. They were interested in the planning and structure of the novel, and I told them that I'd been writing this diary through some of it, and that it would show how late certain key ideas came to me. Simon's role, for instance, and lots else besides. They genuinely didn't believe me. It must have all been in your head. Perhaps it was. But I was buggered if I could get it out, as a glance through September will show. Bed at 1:30. Too many Armagnacs. Thursday, 28th of October, 1993. Up feeling V queer. Simply not well at all, fluey and peculiar. Lurched over to Gress Street for a VO, managed it somehow, and then staggered back to receive Hugh for a day's work. Not very capable for most of the day, but I managed to bang down a couple of sketches. Slept for 2 hours on the sofa round about midday. That helped a little, I suppose. At 6:30, I trotted over to the Paris Theatre, just 2 minutes' walk, God bless where I live, for the news quiz. Me and Alan Corran versus Richard Ingrams and Peter Cook. Alan and I won convincingly, the biggest win of the series, 20-6. Quite a lark, really. I managed to say the word clitoris a number of times, which is always pleasing. Then struggled over to the Groucho to see if some poker and coke wouldn't help push me out of my flu. Funnily enough, it did. Won convincingly, and we broke up at 12:30-ish, highly civilised. Met a fellow called intriguingly and very Soho 50s-ly Nick the Basque. Home and asleep by 1. Friday, 29th of October, 1993. felt very bouncy and much improved by the time Hugh came round at 10:30, worked and fiddled at sketches, and then at 6 Robin Hardy came round to go through the script of Bachelors Anonymous, the idea being to see if there was any chance of working out a rough-and-ready schedule. How many days shooting in France, how many in studio, how many on location, that kind of thing. Pleasant enough time chatting it through until 9. Then I bunged myself over to 2 Bridges Place for a dinner with Ian Brown, Alfredo and Cosmo Fry. Footnotes. Ian Brown, film producer friend. Alfredo Fernandini, Peruvian founder of the club 2 Bridges Place. Cosmo Fry, elegant playboy, distant cousin, chocolate heir. End of footnote. Turned out that on Booker night, Roddy Doyle and party had come over after the award to continue their celebrations. Then who turned up but Salman Rushdie, on his own? Highly risky, you'd have thought. Footnote. The fatwa still very much in place then. End footnote. Pleasant dinner, followed by 2 rounds of Perudo. Then, bother it, it was 2 suddenly, and I have to be up at the crack tomorrow to take a train to Bath. Poo. Saturday, 30th of October, 1993. Struggled out of bed at 7:30 after 3 hours' sleep, into a car driven by some maniac who wanted to tell me about his idea for a novel. I asked if I could be given this job specially. I dare say I'll hear from him again sometime. Was being towed around by a girl called Alex Lancaster, who seemed very sweet. The usual pretty leggy thing that they employ for these gigs. That sounds very sexist, but it can't be a coincidence, surely. We arrived in Bristol and were met by a charming Reed Publishers rep called Andrew Whittaker, snatched a cup of coffee in the Bristol Waterstones and went out to meet the queue. A lot of signing, but very friendly. The manager said it was a record attendance, most books sold in such a session ever. Gratifying. Footnote. I think I'm right in saying that the student Derren Brown was in this queue and that I encouraged him to work hard at practising his magic. Oh dear, condescending or what? End footnote. Then we went off to another Waterstones in Bristol where I was interviewed by a TV crew and signed some stock. Then we drove off to Bath where the queue was astronomical. Really wore my hand out. 2 very strange psycho fans turned up. Trembling, barely able to speak. One of them said, "Oh my God, I'm coming, I'm coming!" Whoops. Finally got through it all, biffed off to W.H. Smith's to sign some stock, and then back to London. Arrived at 7, in time to snatch over to 2 Bridges Place again, for Kim's birthday party. Highly agreeable. Chatted to Sean Slovo a lot. Footnote. The screenwriter daughter of Joe Slovo, a leading anti-apartheid voice. As a communist Jew, Joe Slovo was one of the Afrikaans right-wing's most hated figures. He became a minister under Mandela and died in 1995. End footnote. And I spoke to Joe Laurie and Kim and lots of other poppets. Greg was on excellent form, and Hugh left at one point to pick up his nephew Hugh Lassen from the airport and bring him back on his motorbike. Rather snazzy for a 17-year-old, I should imagine, being whisked through town on the pillion of a triumph by your famous uncle. Left at 1-ish and tumbled, tired but stupid, into bed. Sunday, 31st of October, 1993. It was all going to fizzle out into a Placido Domingo. Footnote. Spanish for a quiet Sunday, but you knew that. End footnote. Got up very late, shopped a little, got the papers and the new Avengers tapes, and snuggled in for the day. Then Kim rang to remind me that I'd left a bag behind at Bridges Place. He and Al would pop round sometime to deliver it to me. Fair enough. Then, of course, it gets later and later in the afternoon, so Kim and Al suggest we meet at Joe Allen's for the handing over of the bag. No sooner sat down at Joe's than the waiter brings me an enormous Armagnac, courtesy of a rather cute young boy sitting elsewhere. Kim and Al very amused. We chat, we chew the fat, we nibble dinner, and time passes. The little chap comes over to our table, about 18, I suppose, and very sweet. "I'm sorry to be gauche," he says. What a divine way to pronounce gauche. We've all done it with words we've only seen written down. Misled and impious, for example, instead of misled and impious. He hands me a note and trots out. The note gives his name, he admires my writings and stance on the age of consent, and gives a telephone number. Do call. Oh, my. Alistair drove me home, and I invited them in for a drink. Alistair didn't want to, but Kim did, so we cheerfully bade him farewell and stayed up for hours and hours. We can talk forever, which is so happy-making. And so the month ends. Monday, 1st of November, 1993. Up in time for a voiceover. Synatogen multivitamins. Do you feel all right? Good bloody question. Struggled back in time for work with Hugh, only to discover that the Spectator needed my copy for the diary today, had completely forgotten the whole damn thing, agreed months ago during a Spectator lunch that I would do the diary column for a couple of weeks, therefore spent most of the day writing that instead of a sketch. I'm a bad bunny. Got it done anyway. Think it's okay. Dreadful news broke about River Phoenix dying. Mortifying. So adored him. I remember changing a line in Peter's Friends to make a mention of him. When Emma's character in the movie tries to seduce me, I tell her that I'm sort of bisexual, but that I don't do anything with anyone at the moment, but if I did, she would be right there at the top of my wish list, along with Michelle Pfeiffer and River Phoenix. Always got a huge laugh. Such a sweet boy. Looks as if his death might be drug-related, which is bizarre, because I always thought he was a terribly straight sort of chap, all environmental concern and poppity prudishness. Oh, cripes. I remember choosing him as a pin-up for the oldie, Yum Yum, I had written. And there on the wall is a photograph of him, just above the desk where Hugh works when we're sketch-writing. I'm looking at him now, so earnestly beautiful. Running on Empty, my favourite film of his. I love all Sidney Lumet's work, and he brought out the absolute best in the phoenix who will never rise from the ashes. Oh dear, I'm actually a bit damp-eyed, a bit like when Bobby Moore died earlier this year. In the evening, hastened to the Garrick for a dinner given by Lord Alexander, the chairman of the NatWest Bank. This had been arranged courtesy of Charles Powell. Arrived in good time to be greeted by Lord A, Bob, as he is known to his chums, thoroughly charming fellow. His wife, Mari, I had sat next to at Charles and Carla's wedding, or rather, the wedding of their son, Hugh. She's a lawyer with a lovely, soft Irish voice, and nice, soft views to go with them. Then Dennis Thatcher turned up, and a strange woman called Bischoff, very nice, but oddly shy or neurotic or something. Dennis, I have to confess, I took to enormously. Right wing, natch, but very wonderful. Much better read than I had ever imagined, loves history, knows a great deal about it too, and was, I think, pleased to talk to someone of my age who wasn't pig-ignorant. Went so far as to describe me as a brilliant conversationalist. Lummy. Home reasonably early. Few lines. Bed. Tuesday, 2nd of November, 1993. Up early and round to the lorries. We are to drive off and inspect the kitchen of my house in Norfolk. Joe has been superintendent in charge of a massive rebuilding project, of a kind that would make a pharaoh think twice. Hugh accompanies, and we drive through a grey day to West Bilney. Amazing job has been done so far. I just didn't recognise anything. The carpentry, the roof lowering, the floor. Incredible, simply incredible. Spent a few hours there chatting to Brendan, the builder. The architect, Nigel Husband, hasn't made provision for facilities for rubbish. Stupid little details, but fantastically important. I compile what I'm told is a snagging list. Cannot believe Joe L.'s skill, commitment and kindness in giving me all this time and talent. Wound our way back via AJ's family restaurant and an enormous burger. Back at the flat, waited for Sam Mendes to come round and talk about the Elton John musical. He likes the script, but wouldn't want to work on anything unless it was much more interesting and dangerous and sharp. Quite right. Makes me feel a prune for being involved in the thing as it stands. He'll talk to John Reed. If I had a couple of months to make it far more original, then he would have loved to have done it. The swine is absolutely right. Not a swine, of course. Thoroughly good man. Still only 28 and one of our best directors. Handsome, too. And brilliant at cricket. Tch, some people. Went with him to the Groucho and we bumped into Griff there. Griff and I proposed and seconded him for the grouch, and we wandered in for sustenance. Old Jim Moyer was there, a.k.a. Vic Reeves, and he joined us for merriment, bought a couple of grams from Jethro, and wandered home in a rather wired condition to watch Stalag Luft as it aired, then Bedness and Blankness. Wednesday, the 3rd of November, 1993. Hugh called in early this morning to report sick, or rather Joe did, on his behalf. Flu, sinus, that kind of nonsense. This has left me with the day to myself, a chance to clear my desk of plenty of correspondence and other dribble. A sketch didn't come, though, so I biked off a mock sketch to Hugh, detailing how difficult it is to write a sketch. A car came at 7-ish to take me to Alice Faye Cleese's. We're off together to the Canteen, the Marco Pierre White restaurant, as guests of Michael and Shakira Kane. Arrive in time for a glass of wine with A.F. Cleese himself is tired, as always, and not up for fun and larks. Hence my role as walker to A.F. We arrive at Chelsea Harbour, and I watch glued at the bar as Norwich keep Bayern Munich to a 1-1 draw and go through 3-2 on aggregate. Yippee! Michael and Shakira join us. Michael grew up in North Runcton near King's Lynn, so he harbours a secret love of Norwich City. Then David and Karina Frost turn up, and we watch until the match is over. David was a fine footballer as a youth and trialled for Norwich, so he supports them too. Good dinner. I sat between Karina and Shakira. The latter is absolutely delightful and almost impossibly beautiful. Karina is just as delightful in a quite splendidly batty way. Terribly enthusiastic about all her friends. Get quietly sozzled. Just one line in the bog, otherwise full behaviour. Thomas Starzewski was at another table and full of beans. Footnote. Polish-born but British couturier whose frocks were much favoured by Princess Diana. End footnote. I told him to be sure and turn up to the Perudo evening. Home at 1-ish and straight to bed. Thursday, the 4th of November, 1993. Up fit and ready for the day, thanks to the previous night's moderation. Joe phoned in to say that Hugh would be staying in bed most of the morning and joining me for an afternoon's Alliance and Leicester voiceover. So I had to face Chris and Jeff from the Labour Party on my own. Hugh and I have agreed to do a party political broadcast for Walworth Road, footnote, where the headquarters of the Labour Party were then situated, end footnote. Jeff Stark is the director. We're doing it because it's actually rather a fun script. Jeff wants us to play all the parts in it, but I think it's best if we don't. For a start, it'll be less work on the day, and there is also the extra element of comedy to be considered that some good and unexpected lovies will be able to add. Brimped off for the voiceover. Hugh looking a bit pale and yucky, a bit drawn and wobbly. All went okay, and I returned to the flat to climb into my best bib and tucker. Zimmed round to Emma's house. I am her date for the preview of Remains of the Day, which also opens the London Film Festival. M being made up by some private makeup artist, so I drink and chat to her. She then climbs into the most stunning top I've ever seen. Its quality is somewhat shat on by the news that it is Armani and costs £6,000. Not even a dress, for the Lord's sake. M hasn't bought it, you understand. They've lent it to her. This is what happens when you win an Oscar. Into the limo and ho for the Odeon Leicester Square. Huge crowds, as always, somewhat amused to see me instead of Ken dismounting. M, like Princess Di, leaps for the crash barriers and chats to the waiting throng. I stand on one leg, looking like an arse, until she joins me. Bit of posing for the paps, and then inside. M has to wait downstairs, because she'll be appearing on stage for the opening speeches, and so on. I go up and find myself next to Jenny Hopkins, wife of Tony, also starring in the movie, and Greta Scacchi. Film, highly enjoyable, perhaps a little too long, but some stunning performances from M and Tony. Then we trot off to the Café Royal for the party. Managed to get a line in the loo before joining the table, where Kim and Sean Slovo were already there. Slovo hated it, Natch, and Kim was less than thrilled, I think. Hugh Grant and his ravishing lady are present. I quiz him on 4 weddings and a funeral, which he has just made. He loathed doing it, thinks he's crap in it, and wanted to punch Mike Newell most of the time. Bet he's brilliant, though. Also asked him about the rumour that Madonna wanted to shag him. Turns out it's true. James Fox, also present. What an absolute sweetie, adorable chap. Very good in the film, too, in that wonderful, mournful, weak way he has. Sir Dickie, Lord Dickie, I beg his pardon, came up and took both my arms and gazed lovingly into my eyes in that way he has and told me I must see Shadowlands. Usual suspects also present included Kenneth Trodd, Ben Kingsley and assorted baggages. Footnote. Kenneth Trodd is a BBC producer best known for his collaborations with Dennis Potter and Simon Gray. End footnote. Walked home pissed but reasonably cheerful round about the 2 o'clock mark. Friday, the 5th of November, 1993. Voiceover at 10 for Biactol, followed by writing with Hugh all day until biffing off to the Garrick for a drink with Robin Bailey. Footnote, the actor who played Uncle Mort in I Didn't Know You Cared, way back before you were born, also the narrator in Tales from the Long Room. We had both been in the happy West End flop Look, Look, the year before. End footnote. He had rung me up with some story about a taxi driver whose first wife had been a waitress at the Chelsea Arts Club. A painting of her hung in the bar. Would I, as a member, take Robin to see if it was there? I said, yes, let's dine there. He suggested meeting first at the Garrick for a snort. Footnote. In its old-fashioned sense of gargle or snifter. A drink, in other words. End footnote. He turned up over an hour late. I think he's gone a bit potty. Incapable of anything other than weird conversation, acting out pretend bitterness at his career. Bit sad. We dribbled off to the Chelsea Arts and awaited Johnny Sessions, who was to join us. He arrived, thank God, and injected some sanity and wit into the proceedings. Drunken dinner, which I hated, had forgotten what a ridiculous place the CAC is. Good initials. Home late. Saturday, 6th of November, 1993. Robin Hardy came round at 10:30, and we worked for hours on the script of Bachelors Anonymous. Ended up feeling more cheerful about it than I had for weeks. Managed to persuade him to cut a number of dodgy scenes and take a more serious view of the love story. Then shopped a bit at Fortnum's and spent the evening in front of the telly. Sober and sweet at bedtime. Sunday, the 7th of November, 1993. Up at 11:15, just in time to climb into a suit for Sir Charles and Lady Powell to pop round and pick me up. We were all going to a lunch at Josephine, nay Hart, and Maurice Sarchi's house in Sussex. Footnote. Josephine Hart was the novelist wife of Maurice Sarchi, now sadly deceased. Known for powerful, rather shocking short novels with one-word titles. Damage, Sin, Oblivion. End footnote. Very grand. The world and his wife were there. Nicholas Soames, bless him, and his intended Serena, Melvin Bragg, Simon Callow and his friend Christopher, footnote, Christopher Wood, designer, now attached to Johnny Shan Kidd, the photographer, end footnote. Sir Norman Fowler, Michael Howard, the Home Secretary, John and Jane Burt, Alan Yentob, Christopher Bland, footnote, BT chief, chairman of endless boards, BBC governors, Royal Shakespeare Company, etc., good egg. End of footnote. Paul Johnson, Simon Jenkins, Gail Honeycutt, Alistair Goodlad, Grey Gowrie, Pamela Harlock, and others too splendid to mention. Wine and chat flowed, all rather good fun. Signed a copy of Paperweight for the Sarchi child, Edmund, who is 8 and very bright, clearly. Josephine told me she had gone into his room last night and found him reading Paperweight. He asked, "Mummy, what does biopsy mean?" Sweet. Rode back with the Powells again, and home in time for telly and bed. Without Coke again. That's 2 nights in a row. It's becoming a habit. Monday, 8th of November, 1993. Hugh couldn't come round today. Meetings for his advert next week. I messed around doing correspondence and sorting things out generally. Voiceover in the morning, followed by a researcher popping round for the Clive Anderson I'm doing on Thursday. While chatting to her, Alice Fay rang up and asked me whether I would like her tickets for the Meistersingers currently wowing them at the Royal Opera House. I squeaked yes with great excitement, said to be a great production. Immediately rang up Johnny Sessions to see if he could come. Starts at 5, of course. He replied with equal alacrity, and I spent the rest of the day in a fever waiting for the tickets to be biked round. Bathed and climbed into a suit, and Johnny appeared at 4. We cabbed into the garden and ordered our first interval drinks. Sir Kenneth Bloomfield was there, a governor of the BBC, Ulster civil servant. I'd met him at Burt evenings, proms, that kind of thing. Simon Hornby, also present. Footnote, head honcho at W.H. Smith, as mentioned earlier. The last family member to lead the company. Then the music drama itself, an absolutely knockout production by Graham Vick, with Bernard Haitink on unbelievable form in the pit, just sensational. Thomas Allen, a fabulous Beckmesser, possibly the best acting performance in London at the moment, never mind the singing. And John Tomlinson, a sensationally dignified and wonderfully voiced sax. Oh, I can't tell you, Daisy dear, the best evening I've had in years and years. One forgets just what a great man Wagner was. This was art. This was total, magical, real, uncompromising art. Genius is, I'm afraid, the only word. Unparalleled genius. We stumbled out into the light and headed for also for our dinner. Ned Cherin was there, natch. Chatted to him a while and chewed the fat. I tried to explain Hegel to Johnny. He said it was fascinating, but that he knew he would forget every detail of it the moment I'd stopped speaking. I know what he means. That's why I love talking and teaching. The act of reproducing ideas out loud reinforces them in the head. If every time you read a complex book or idea, you had to explain it to someone else, you'd never forget it. We shogged back to my place a little drunk and stayed up for hours. Johnny stayed in the spare room and I fell into bed, unable to sleep till way past 4. Tuesday the 9th of November, 1993. Woke Johnny at 8:15 and fell back to slumber. Dimly remember Jay bidding me farewell. Joe forwarded me a letter to tell me that a set had become available in Albany. Then other Joe, Joe Laurie, rang to say that I had to go round to a bed shop in Chelsea with her to choose 5 new beds for West Bilney. She turned up in a cab with Hugh. Hugh went into work and I zipped off with Joe. In an hour, I spent 11,750-odd quid on some beautiful beds and 600 quid on material to upholster one of them. Stunning stuff, though. Then back through terrible traffic, state visit of Their Majesties the King and Queen of Malaysia or some such, to the flat. Hugh stayed for a while and then went off to interview a headmaster for the boys' prep school. I rang the secretary of the Albany Trustees and arranged to see it this afternoon. Set up a meeting, too, with Jethro at the Grouch at 5. Messed about, then the copy-edited proofs of the Hippo arrived, and I went through them. Off to the Albany next. I think the set has great potential. I'd need to redecorate quite substantially. Definitely an exciting prospect. No children, no dogs, no noise, no publicity are their rules. Then to the Groucho for an hour or so, scored a couple of grams off Jethro and popped upstairs for a wine tasting, which was charming. Back home to meet one Sir Peter Ratcliffe, who is in charge of the charity for which I'm speaking at the premiere of The Man Without a Face next week. He told me all the stuff about the evening and when I was to make my address. The Prince of Wales is delighted that you are speaking, all that sort of thing. I'm going to have to be rather good, I fear. Then to the Groucho again, bit more wine-tasting, and down Old Compton Street to the Ivy, where I was due to have dinner with Thomas Starzewski. There was a sign on his doorbell which said, 9:10, Stephen gone to the Ivy. This rather confused me, as my watch assured me that it was only 8:30. Toddled to the Ivy, no sign of the man. Then he turned up. The sign was left over from yesterday. Dole! He thought he had arranged to see me on Monday. In fact, it was definitely Tuesday. Anyway, no harm done. Charming evening, all well. He lent me the Witkiewicz reader. Back home by one-ish. Read in bed. Wednesday, 10th of November, 1993. Somehow, an incredibly busy day on the phone. Sorting out the Perudo evening on the 17th, who's to be on my table, that kind of thing. Also, I have taken the more or less momentous decision to go for the Albany set that I saw yesterday. A lot of work needed. Forward Joe Laurie and her team. But it could be something, I think. Rang around the place trying to get references for the Albany trustees. Banker plus two personal. Tried to get hold of Charles Powell, but he's all